everyone, and welcome to Minute 92 of Season 8 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we FUBAR our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Jim O'Kane of TV Dads, of the Apollo 13 Minute, of October Sky Minute, of Airplane Minute, of the Rocketeer Minute. Of the
airport minute, Captain by the America. Way.
Oh, did I say airplane?
Yeah, airport. Yeah, we didn't do airplane. We did have Robert Hayes on. But yeah.
Sorry, airport minute. I was so close. And the upcoming Captain America minute. Did I get them all? Did I miss something?
Yeah, well, they're in there somewhere. Don't worry. Tune in, and we've got links to all the other ones. So if you find one, you'll find them all. Rob, thanks for having me on. It's great being back on the show.
Yeah, hopefully today we'll have a little more upbeat things to talk about. Maybe. Yes. I don't know.
Please, yes.
So, minute 92 begins with the men pretty much all looking as if they're completely in shock. And ends with Miller joining everyone along with this prisoner. So yesterday we basically went through the death throes of Wade. He'd gotten his two shots of morphine and decided to call out for his mother or whatever. And the beginning of this minute is pretty much silence because everyone's just looking around. They don't really know what to do. You know, it makes you wonder if this is the first time that they are intimately dealing with someone dying in their arms like this.
Yeah, it's I mean, they did have Caparzo die, but he was kind of isolated from all.
That's right. Yeah. They were watching him from afar, telling him to stay down or whatever it is, but he still just he was just lying there.
Yeah,
They weren't cradling him like they are here.
Yeah, I mean, he was literally breathing his dying breaths in their faces as he was going. So this is a very personal and very, almost, you might want to say, intimate look at someone's death.
Yeah, completely. And I mean, that's again, we see all the blood. The blood's on their hands. The blood's all over Wade. Obviously at this point it stopped flowing, for obvious reasons. But they did what they could. You know, they were all trying to help as much as possible. And then we see Miller do something very interesting. He reaches out and opens up, Wade's, shirt pocket and pulls out, a piece of paper from there, which obviously he gets a little bit of blood on it also. Whatever.
Yeah.
Now, the question is, and I don't know the answer to this. Was it a known thing that that's the pocket where you keep, like, your letter to your family or something like that if something happens? You know, and therefore, you know, if something happens, we know that to go into the left breast pocket and we can take from there a letter home or, you know, with your, I don't know, last will and testament or something like that.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that as a place where they keep a prepared last will and testament or whatever you'd keep in that pocket. I would think that you'd have like a pen or a pencil to write stuff down, but I wouldn't imagine that you carry your letter to home. By the way, I'm dead. Thing in your pocket there.
Right now, I mean, we did see a few weeks ago that Wade was recopying Caparzo's letter.
Right. You know, so yeah, the bloodstained one. Yeah.
That's right. It's also possible that this is Caparzo's letter. But then, like, how would Miller know that he needs to go into the left breast pocket and take out the letter?
Unless he saw Wade put it there. They were all pretty close, so maybe he knew that's where it was from.
Maybe.
Or that's where it was going to be, yeah.
You know, it adds the question, is this letter, a letter from Wade, or is this Caparzo's letter that will be transferred from man to man.
For
the movie.
Yeah, it's so many mysteries in all of this.
You know, that that I wanted to discuss with you, because I thought maybe you would have some insight about how these things work, you know, because it does the way that Miller does it, he takes it out like right away. He's not like searching for something. So it makes it seem as if it's something that's ordinary, that this is what you do.
Unfortunately, I had an uncle who was in the infantry, and wound up getting captured the first day of the Battle of the Bulge, and had to walk across Belgium and across Germany to a prisoner of war camp. And it wasn't known that he had been captured until, I think, the end of March of 1945. He was captured in the first week of January in 1945. But there was no communication. So I'm not sure if, you know, how what the communication was like for people in the field to get stuff home. You know, where are you going to post this letter? How do you, you know, and I guess you're relying on the buddies in your platoon to get it back to somebody. I'm not sure. I would guess that this is something that the screenwriter had gotten from different diaries or reports, you know, from war stories. But as to it being common, I have no idea.
Right. I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned it. I mean, there's a movie that came out just a few months ago that dealt with the whole idea of the mail system.
And the backup that they had trying to get letters to and from the front lines, where, you know, soldiers, I mean, their morale relied on letters. I know I have two letters from I have two letters from my father. He was in the 9th Army Air Corps. He was a fireman, and his job was to put out planes that were on fire when they landed, and pulling people out of broken airplanes. And in between the bombing runs, he was pretty much on the airfield waiting for the planes to come back. And he taught himself how to use a typewriter while he was there. There was nothing else to do, so all the mission reports, all the pilots were up in the air. So he was back at the airfield with a typewriter. So he got out the Army field manual and how to use it, of what it was like spending Christmas just south of Paris. I can't think of the name, the guy that played Faraday, I'm lost. The one guy that had the translator, he had a typewriter with him, but apparently typewriters
were not that.
Yeah, Upham. That's right. Upham. That's right. He had, typewriters were not that uncommon in the battlefield.
Well, in this movie, we've already seen two typewriters in this movie, because, you know, I know that Tom Hanks is a typewriter aficionado. Even during the assault on the beach, he is dealing with somebody who has a typewriter.
Yeah, and my dad said that he learned on an Underwood number 5, and so he would type away and send letters home to my grandmother, and let him know how things are going. He just, in the upper corner where you're writing your address, he just writes somewhere in France or somewhere in England. And you know, I did not know about these letters until long after my father passed. My cousin had found a box that my aunt had, and it had a bunch of these souvenirs of the war, of things that were going on with my dad. And it was just really nice seeing this long after he had passed, just being able to read his words of a 19-year-old guy who was, you know, overseas during the Battle of the Bulge. But it's, you know, it's intriguing thinking about how the words that were coming home from so many people. I mean, besides the people that were alive sending letters, the compatriots of the men that died trying to tell families at home what it was like when, you know, where they lost their lives. Just a gripping thing to think about. But again, I don't know if everybody's upper left breast pocket was their portable mailbox or, you know, their important documents pocket.
Okay. No, it's a good question. I mean, so the movie that I was referring to, it came out at the end of 2024 called The 6888.
Yes.
It was actually just also nominated for an Oscar for best song from that. But a week from when this episode will go out, they'll know whether it won or not. My bet is it probably didn't, even though I think it is one of the better songs of the nominated songs, but whatever, that's neither here nor there. But
this grief stage.
Have you seen this movie, The 6888?
Yes, I have. Yeah. And it's on Netflix, I believe.
Quite possibly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually a pretty good film. I enjoyed it a lot. It's, from what they had to work with, the story, I think they were trying to expand the story as a bigger thing. But the acting was very good, and it did point out a problem that they had. They kind of stretched it a bit. It was from what I understand, the mail corps that had straightened out the postal problems, who did a fantastic job of it, didn't actually get involved in it until March or April of 1945. So it was kind of like at the very end of the war. But it, you know, they did clear up a big problem, and at the, you know, at the end of the war, people are saying, "Well, I'll be coming home soon, and where, you know, here's who I am." And being able to clear it up, it would have been nicer if they could have fixed the distribution problems earlier in the war. But by the time I think it was an all women corps had shown up, it was a real mess over there, and being able to fix all that and get mail back. So that, you know, people could tell their relatives, by the way, the war's over, I'm coming home. That's, you know, pretty key piece of correspondence to get back home. But it's a very well acted film, I thought, and the cinematography wasn't as good as it could have been, I think, but I'm not sure what the budget was for the film, but I thought all the actors in the film were very good.
Yeah, no, I liked also the message of it. You know, the idea that here we have, you know, and it's related to what we're talking about here, about the whole idea.
Sure,
about how do you, you know, I mean, we joked that you know, the left breast pocket is the mailbox, but still, the idea is that you know, it's great for morale both overseas and on the home front. You know, that you're getting a message, even if it's months later. You know, I mean, even with Minnesota Ryan, he just said, "I just sent the letter home right before we shipped out, you know, of England." You know, so obviously his you know, brothers in elementary school are okay.
I mean, that's terrifying. And they didn't get a return receipt. You know, so you're never sure if the mail ever made it back or how long it took or where they were going. My dad, in all of his notes, said, "You know, would you mind sending cookies? Because we're really short on cookies here. So if you could send some cookies that last, oatmeal cookies are fine." And so it was interesting to see what, you know, what he wanted to get in the mail from them.
So, oh wow!
And of course,
I think if you were sending cookies back in the 1940s, you know, it would probably you'd be eating crumbs.
Yeah. Just make sure, you know, I think if they were anything like my grandmother's cookies later on, I'm sure they were very sturdy oatmeal cookies that could probably survive being dipped in the ocean for a week. They're very, very sturdy. She had very sturdy recipes. They're almost washable cookies, I would say. But it's interesting just seeing you get little hints. My dad wrote back the day after Christmas, and he said that he was upset that he had overslept on Christmas Day, and for a special treat, his company received eggs, fresh eggs, and
oh, wow.
nobody woke him up, and so he by the time he got there, the eggs were gone and he had to eat powdered eggs. And I know for the rest of his life, as all I knew him growing up and into adulthood, he hated any kind of powdered eggs. He just wanted fresh eggs because he missed them on Christmas Day, 1944. I remember that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's problematic. I can understand that.
Yeah.
And so at this point, the shot changes and we, you know, they give us a little bit of a few more somber moments of watching the reactions of the men, you know, to the death of Wade. And Miller just gets up and walks away from everyone else, so putting this piece of paper in his pocket. And then the scene changes and we see that Ryben, who is not with them, is you know, beating up the German prisoner.
Yeah.
And we see that it's a very far distance between the place where Wade was shot and, you know, the tower itself, you know, where Ryben is, where he's beating this guy, you know, with the butt of his gun. And then we see one of the guys start running up the hill, and we see that it's Jackson, and he goes, "Ryben, hold him." And Jackson, you know, gets up there. They're obviously, we can see that they're just really upset about everything. And Jackson comes and you have to really be paying attention, but he really gives this prisoner a wallop. It's like he's running and just bashes him in the head with something.
Yeah, it's you know,
whether he's holding his gun already or something else, but he's just really letting out his anger here.
Yeah, it reminded me of I always go back to Henry V, and in the Battle of Agincourt, there's a scene where the young boys that carried the luggage, all the supplies, the French had cut through the English lines and had cut the throats of these young boys who were carrying all the luggage, the tools and the food and all that behind the lines. And Henry V comes out and looks around at the dead bodies of the young boys. And he says, "I was not angry since I came to France until this instant." And then he turns to the herald and says, "Take a trumpet, herald. Ride thou unto the horsemen on yon hill. If they will fight with us, bid them come down or void the field. They do offend our sight. If they'll do neither, we will come to them and make them scurry away as swift as stones enforced from the old Assyrian slings. Besides, we'll cut the throats of those we have, and not a man of them that we shall take shall taste our mercy. Go and tell them so." So, you know, even 700 years before this event, there were some really ticked off soldiers in northern France.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And I mean, first of all, this is a great shot because they don't show it up close.
Yeah.
We just see it from afar. And then we see Mellish run up also after. And then Ryben and Jackson take this prisoner and throw him onto the ground. And they start kicking him and beating him and everything. And Mellish reaches there and Mellish gets involved also. And then we finally get to see it, you know, from a close-up. And we see the three of them basically getting ready just to execute this guy. Somehow Jackson has a pistol. You know, probably brought it from home.
Yeah,
making sure he's got what he needs. Yeah,
yeah. What you were saying about seeing it from a distance is like we are the ones standing next to Wade's body.
That's
and
right.
Watching all this going on, and we're running up to him to see if we can join in or be at least a witness to it. But it's very visceral anger.
Yeah. Yeah. And then so Mellish joins in and he starts, beating him. They throw off the guy's helmet. We see that the guy's bleeding. Jackson checks his gun just to make sure he's got enough bullets in there. Cocks the gun, gets ready to start shooting him. You can see behind this prisoner, you see another one of the dead Germans behind him. He just starts talking in German. I don't know what he says, obviously. And then basically the execution is halted by Miller, who is just walking up the hill. I mean, the others, the other guys were running up. Miller just walk up and he screams, "Not yet." And, you know, we're going to have to wait until tomorrow to find out what his initial plan is. But, you know, we know that you know, the other three guys were just ready to shoot this guy. It wasn't going to take him very long. You know, we even see it looks like a firing squad, by the way, that Ryben and Mellish are just holding their guns up to him. And as Miller joins them, that's where this minute ends.
You know, yeah, so grim.
It's very grim, but again, it shows the anger that these guys are trying to get out. And, you know, they have this opportunity right now because of the fact that here we are in a little bit of a reprieve. I mean, if they were in the middle of a full battle, they wouldn't be able to do these type of things. You know, and they're looking at it that their friend was just killed, and they want to enact some sort of revenge on this guy. So did you have anything else you wanted to say about this particular minute?
No, it's I didn't know I was going to have things to say about this minute when I first watched it. I'm like, gosh, what am I going to talk about here? But yeah, there's so many things going on, and you know, the emotions that are just flying across the screen are very impressive. And again, you know, it's great editing and great cinematography of being a part. The setup of the camera makes you complicit in what's going on. You're part of that firing squad.
Yeah, I mean, Spielberg, there's no question about it. Spielberg knows how to set up these shots. You know, he's definitely the master here of how to do this type of things. Because, as you said, we feel as if we're right there. And that was that was his intent. I mean, he made this movie for, you know, the dying men of the Greatest Generation, including his father, including, you know, all. He wanted this movie to come out at a time when the ones that were still around could still watch it and appreciate it. And unfortunately, a lot of them, you know, it helped them on some levels, but it also brought everything back to them on other levels.
Yeah. And I mean, during, you know, there was such a plethora between this and Band of Brothers and the Pacific. You know, there's so much going on at the time of people trying to take one last crack at understanding the mood, the intent, the emotions of being a part of the Greatest Generation. It was a great time for movie making.
Was your father still around in 1998?
Yes. I don't know how he felt about this film. He didn't usually watch a lot of war movies. He, like many people in World War II, a lot of veterans didn't really discuss it. My uncle, who was a POW, my uncle weighed 86 pounds when he came home after getting out of one day he woke up and all the guards were gone from the stockade, and he just walked out and found an American platoon that was sweeping the countryside looking for POW camps. He never really talked about it until my son asked him about it at my aunt's funeral, and he started chatting about it. But it was, I mean, late in life that he discussed it. I think that was a whole generation where they really didn't. My dad said the people that talked about the most about it were the ones that did the least in it. That was his impression. He said the people who were on the who were fighting on the front lines, they really didn't want to get into it too much.
I don't know if George Lewis Jr. would agree with you on that one.
Yeah. I mean, I would think, you know, Audie Murphy didn't have any problems with making whole movies about things.
Right. But, at the end of this season, I have an interview with, I will be publishing an interview with, that I did with George Lewis Jr., who is one of the sons of the Band of Brothers.
Cool. And wow.
He talks about the fact that, you know, that most of these men who, as anyone who's read the book Band of Brothers or seen the miniseries knows, you know, they did do a lot of fighting. They were in the thick of things. He said that many of them didn't discuss it among their families, but when they would have their yearly conventions, you know, where they would all meet up, then they would talk about it, you know, with one another. And only years later did they start passing things over to the, you know, to the next generation.
Major Winter said that he said, I was not a hero, but I was in the company of heroes. I think that's how most of them felt,
right?
That the real heroes they left behind on the, you know, on the field.
That's right.
And you know, it's quite understandable. My good friend of mine in Winchester, Virginia, who later became a Quaker minister, was a tank commander, and he said he didn't really have religion until after he came home. But after seeing war up close, he never wanted it to be part of anybody's lives again. And when talking with him about the war, my son talked with him about it to do a report for school. And he said it was the first time that he had ever talked about it since he got back, which was, wow, you know, 50 years in the past or 70 years in the past. He said the only thing that he wanted his, you know, his children and his grandchildren to know is war is the worst thing that can happen in, you know, between human beings. And when, you know, I remember a lot of World War II vets, if they did talk about it at all, you could watch their eyes and they'd turn into this extremely faraway look that you could see them time traveling when they were talking about things. My dad used to get very distracted when if you'd asked him about what it was like with you know, A-26s or B-25s, any kind of aircraft, he'd start talking about it. And then he'd bring up something where there was this one time, and he'd start talking about it, but then he'd stop talking about it because I think the memories were too harsh. He saw a lot of people that didn't make it, that he had to pull a lot of airplanes. And I know that affected him and his views about warfare and about you know, being about continued wars. I think some of the most passive, I don't want to say pacifist, but most peace-minded people are veterans. I think having seen war, you want it to end.
Right,
and I think it's just as true today as it was back in the 40s.
Yeah, I think that's completely true. And that's all I have to say about this minute. So, yeah. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Tom Hanks Tuesday, where my guests give their top five Tom Hanks performances. So once again, start with your number five and work your way up.
My number five, I did enjoy. He's not the star of the movie, but most of the ones that I have here, he's sometimes the star, but mostly not the star. Number five, when he got to portray Walt Disney in Saving Mr. Banks, I thought he did a great job being Walt Disney. I don't think anybody can directly be Walt Disney, but I think he captured the essence of Disney when you watch him. I used to read a lot of Disney biographies, and I thought he really captured the whole idea behind Disney and what he was trying to do in making Mary Poppins. Number four is a longtime favorite of mine. When he played the character Josh in the movie Big, he really knew how to be a 10-year or a 9 or a 10-year-old in an adult body. I thought that was
I think he was 12-year-old, if I remember correctly.
Was he 12? Okay.
He
looked like he could do a kid so well. And yes. Any movie with Robert Loggia can't be all bad. It's
especially when he plays the piano.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, with his feet. So a great film. Number three, I wasn't sure how to score all these, so it's kind of a compilation. All the Toy Story movies. I think being a voice actor, you could feel everything that he did on screen. I don't think we would have loved Woody as much as we would if somebody else besides Tom Hanks had played the role. I thought he did just such a fantastic job being Woody. His voice was perfect. His consistent state of outrage was wonderful. So I can watch Toy Story movies. I think they're going to be an eternal thing that you'll be able to watch them with your great great grandchildren. So,
but if you had to choose one of them, which one would you choose?
I'd go with the first one because that's where he created the role. I think that was that was really a great thing there.
I actually just rewatched it yesterday.
Oh really? Okay. I watched I think it was Toy Story 3. I watched Toy Story 3 with my oldest granddaughter. I didn't know about the part where they're holding each other's hands as they're going into the fire. I was like, wait a minute, this is not something for a little kid. But it all came out okay. But it's like, wait, what are we watching here? So that was a little rough for little kids. But they did kill Bambi's mom. So you know, I think that bar had already been set by Disney. Number two, funny enough, I've done a whole podcast about this number two movie. It's Jim Lovell, commander of Apollo 13. I thought he did a great job. You can tell how much he loves Jim Lovell. Jim Lovell's a great guy. If you ever talk with him, he's Tom Hanks, or Tom Hanks is Jim Lovell, or the other way around. I don't know. I can't tell the two apart. They're very much alike. Except Lovell did go to the moon. So twice. So I put that down as my number two. And number one, it's just for one brief scene. It's at the end of the 1996 film, That Thing You Do, Mr. White. He plays Mr. White. And he has this conversation with Sketch, trying to figure out about who the different members of the band were in and how Sketch related to the different people in the band. So it was like he goes through all the band members and what they were like, and then he gets to Liv Tyler's character, Faye, and Tom Hanks, Mr. White, the character in there, teaches Sketch that Sketch is really in love with Faye, and that he's kind of the matchmaker for them, that he's the right one to be. He needs to be with Faye. And it's just this one little scene, but it makes the whole film. So I think my number one is him playing Mr. White in That Thing You Do.
Oh, wow. Okay. That is a great list. Thank you very much for that. So why don't you once again tell people where they can find Jim O'Kane?
You can find me right now. The latest one, the latest podcast that we've done is the movie October Sky by October Sky. Homer Hickam joined us for many episodes. You can find us out there, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, wherever you're looking. We're probably out. Wherever you're listening to this podcast, you'll probably find ours. We've got another one coming up in December. Looking forward to having everybody listen to us. We're going to be going over the Marvel Cinematic Universe movie, Captain America: The First Avenger, and lots of surprise guests on that. Some interesting backgrounds on it, and it's the first movie I've ever done that takes place, or that was made or released in the 21st century. So finally, I'm actually doing a movie that people may have seen. So it'll be interesting to hear the responses to this. But it all starts December 1st, 2025 at a podcasting podcatcher near you.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. Find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, MovieRobMinute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to MovieRobMinute@MovieRob.net. So until tomorrow.
Earnest. In my solitude.